President Wilson was responding to the thought and conditions of his own people and his own country based on a liberal tradition that had first found its full expression in English speech. But to Europe and Asia he seemed to be thinking and saying, for the first time in history, things hitherto undeveloped and altogether secret, and that misconception he may have shared. We are dealing here with an able and successful professor of political science who didn't fully realize what he owed to his contemporaries and the literary and political atmosphere he had breathed throughout his life, and who passed very rapidly after his re-election as president from the mental attitudes of a political leader to those of a messiah. His notes are a series of explorations of the elements of the world situation. When at last, in his address to Congress of January 8, 1918, he produced his 14 points as a definite statement of the American peace intentions, they were, as a statement, far better in their spirit than in their arrangement and matter. This document demanded open agreements between nations and an end to secret diplomacy, free navigation of the high seas, free commerce, disarmament, and a number of political readjustments upon the lines of national independence. Finally, in the 14th point, it required a general association of nations to guarantee the peace of the world. These 14 points had an immense reception throughout the world. Here at last seemed a peace for reasonable men everywhere, as good and acceptable to honest and decent Germans and Russians as to honest and decent Frenchmen and Englishmen and Belgians. And for some months the whole world was lit by faith in Wilson. Could they have been made the basis of a world settlement in 1919, they would forthwith have opened a new and more hopeful era in human affairs. But, as we must tell, they didn't do that. There was about President Wilson a certain egotism. There was, in the generation of people in the United States to whom this great occasion came, a generation born in security, reared in plenty, and, so far as history goes, in ignorance, a generation remote from the tragic issues that had made Europe grave, a certain superficiality and lightness of mind. It wasn't that the American people were superficial by nature and necessity, but that they had never been deeply stirred by the idea of a human community larger than their own. It was an intellectual but not a moral conviction with them. One had, on the one hand, these new people of the New World with their new ideas, their finer and better ideas of peace and world righteousness, and on the other the old, bitter, deeply entangled peoples of the great power system, and the former were crude and rather childish in their immense inexperience, and the latter were seasoned and bitter and intricate. The theme of this clash of the raw idealist youthfulness of a new age with the experienced ripeness of the old was treated years ago by that great novelist Henry James in a very typical story called Daisy Miller. It's the pathetic story of a frank, trustful, high-minded but rather simple-minded American girl with a real disposition towards righteousness and a great desire for a good time, and how she came to Europe and was swiftly entangled and put in the wrong and at last driven to welcome death by the complex tortuousness and obstinate limitations of the older world. There have been 1,000 variants of that theme in real life, 1,000 such transatlantic tragedies, and the story of President Wilson is one of them. But it isn't to be supposed, because the new thing succumbs to the old infections, that is the final condemnation of the new thing. Probably no fallible human being manifestly trying to do his best amidst overwhelming circumstances has been subjected to such minute, searching, and pitiless criticism as President Wilson. He's blamed, and it would seem that he's rightly blamed, for conducting the war and the ensuing peace negotiations on strictly party lines. He remained the president representing the American Democratic Party, when circumstances conspired to make him the representative of the general interests of mankind. He made no attempt to forget party issues for a time, and to incorporate with himself such great American leaders as ex-President Roosevelt, ex-President Taft, and the like. He didn't draw fully upon the moral and intellectual resources of the states. He made the whole issue too personal, and he surrounded himself with merely personal adherents. And a still graver error was his decision to come to the peace conference himself. Nearly every experienced critic seems to be of opinion that he should have remained in America, in the role of America, speaking occasionally as if a nation spoke. Throughout the concluding years of the war, he had, by that method, achieved an unexampled position in the world. Says Dr. Dillon, "Europe, when the president touched its shores, was as clay ready for the creative potter. Never before were the nations so eager to follow a Moses who would take them to the long-promised land where wars are prohibited and blockades unknown." And to their thinking, he was that great leader. In France, men bowed down before him with awe and affection. Labor leaders in Paris told me that they shed tears of joy in his presence, and that their comrades would go through fire and water to help him to realize his noble schemes. To the working classes in Italy, his name was a heavenly clarion at the sound of which the earth would be renewed. The Germans regarded him and his humane doctrine as their sheet anchor of safety. The fearless Helmulon said, "If President Wilson were to address the Germans and pronounce a severe sentence upon them, they would accept it with resignation and without a murmur and set to work at once." In German Austria, his fame was that of a savior, and the mere mention of his name brought balm to the suffering and surcease of sorrow to the afflicted. Such was the overpowering expectation of the audience to which President Wilson prepared to show himself. He reached France on board the George Washington in December 1918. He brought his wife with him. That seemed, no doubt, a perfectly natural and proper thing to an American mind. Quite a number of the American representatives brought their wives. Unhappily, a social quality, nay, almost a tourist quality, was introduced into the world settlement by these ladies. Transport facilities were limited, and most of them arrived in Europe with a radiant air of privilege. They came as if they came to a treat. They were, it was intimated, seeing Europe under exceptionally interesting circumstances. They would visit Chester, or Warwick, or Windsor en route, for they might not have a chance of seeing these celebrated places again. Important interviews would be broken off to get in a visit to some old historical mansion. This may seem a trivial matter to note in the history of mankind, but it was such small human things as this that drew a miasma of futility over the peace conference of 1919. In a little while, one discovered that Wilson, the hope of mankind, had vanished, and that all the illustrated fashion papers contained pictures of a delighted tourist and his wife, grouped smilingly with crowned heads and such like enviable company. It's so easy to be wise after the event, and to perceive that he shouldn't have come over. The men he had chiefly to deal with, for example, Monsieur Clemenceau in France, Mr. Lloyd George and Mr. Balfour in Britain, Baron Sonnino and Signor Orlando in Italy, were men of widely dissimilar historical traditions, but in one respect they resembled him and appealed to his sympathies. They, too, were party politicians who had led their country through the war. Like himself, they had failed to grasp the necessity of entrusting the work of settlement to more specially qualified men. They were the merest novices in international affairs. G. Geography, ethnology, psychology, and political history were sealed books to them.